So then from there, I went into the San Francisco County Jail, and it's in downtown San Francisco. And so they walk you into this thing, and they've got these rows of cells on tiers. Each one of these is a 12-man cell. And they're long enough for three rows of bunk beds on each side. And then there's a toilet on the end. And then there's another cell that's next to it that during the day for 12 hours, they open that cell up. And it's the cell that you get to actually move around in. And it's the same size. It just doesn't have any beds in it. And then there's a TV in there bolted to the wall. And there's a shower there that's an open shower. I didn't really have any problems with any of the people that were in a cell with me, and I didn't really experience any even animosity from anybody. And you know, there was even kind of some camaraderie in the cell. I had long hair, and I was wearing overalls, and you know, it was kind of probably a typical kind of San Francisco hippie kind of guy to them. And I was in there about, I think, 2 or 3 days, and then they shipped me to another cell. It was a 2-man cell, but there wasn't anybody else in it. And they had me there overnight. The next day was when the U.S. Marshals came and, you know, loaded me up in their car with another guy. They couldn't ship me to Lompoc, which is Southern California, nearer where I am. They couldn't have shipped me to McNeil Island or whatever it is in Washington, which is even still nearer. They had to ship me all the way to, you know, Safford, Arizona, out in the middle of bumfuck nowhere. There's a little town of Safford, and there's nothing there. Probably to try and make it so it was more and more difficult for family or whatever to come visit. So they loaded me up in the back of this car, and we headed off down to L.A. We had to pick up a guy in L.A. It was October of 1972. And these two U.S. Marshals were, you know, they were hip cops. They were wearing bell-bottom, you know, uniforms, and not really uniforms even. They were kind of plain clothes. And we were in like a Thunderbird or a, you know, just two doors and two guys in the back seat and driving down to L.A. And the World Series was on. The Oakland A's were playing somebody. I can't even remember who they were playing. And so we just drive down the road and listen to the World Series in the back of this thing. And the marshals were real decent guys. They talked to us like we were normal people and treat us like normal people. And, you know, just they handcuffed us and shackled our feet together, and just on down the road we went, and, you know, rooting on the A's, and they won. And I mean, it was a bad experience in the sense that you're going off to jail,
you're shackled,
but you know, the people that you're in the car with aren't weirdos or strange people or treating you weird or anything. And so then we got to Safford, and Safford is what a lot of people call, you know, country clubs. They don't have big walls or anything. They're minimum security. There are these huge dormitories. So there's like, you know, 6 or 8 dormitories with 50 guys in each one of them. And they're just big open rooms with a short wall, maybe 3 feet tall down the middle, with beds pushed up to it and then beds on the walls. And so, you all just sleep there, and you've got this little like 2x3 locker next to your bed that you've got a padlock for. And that's where you live with all these people. Probably 2/3 of them were Mexican aliens, busted for jumping the border a bunch of times or for smuggling or whatever. But most of them were not even American citizens. They were Mexican citizens serving time in a U.S. prison. And they actually would make some money and send the money home from the prison. And I can't remember what we got paid, but it was $2 a day. It was some ridiculous amount of money, but you had an account there, and there was a place that you could buy cigarettes or candy or crackers or something other than the normal food or normal things. So, you know, I enter Safford and start my life there with no idea about, you know, who's what or what's going on. And they start talking to me about, okay, so we need to get you a job. So tell me something about yourself. Have you been to college? Yeah, I went to college. I graduated from college. Okay, so we've got a job on a survey crew working for the Bureau of Public Roads. So they're building this huge road all the way up to the top of Mount Graham. And Mount Graham's 10,700 feet high or whatever. What I found out later is there are these several high-tech observatories up there. And so they're blasting rock, and you know, it was all stuff that it was completely new to me. I had no idea about it. And so that's what I did for the period of time I was there, was I'd go up on this mountain in the morning and we'd survey for the road. And in the evenings after we'd get off work, we'd play ping pong, or on the weekends we'd play ping pong. And we'd played thousands of games of ping pong. I mean, there wasn't anything else to do. But while I was there, I met a whole lot of really interesting, decent people. Federal crimes aren't generally violent crimes. They're usually bank robbery, or, I mean, as violent as it gets normally. But most of the people that were where I was were there for lesser crimes, or they had committed a major crime and had done 6 years in prison and were now being prepared for release. So they were kind of on their best behavior as well. There were a whole lot of Jehovah's Witnesses in there, and other kind of religious faiths were in there for refusing induction, who were gentle, kind, caring people who wouldn't hurt a soul. And then there were all of these Mexican aliens. One of the things they would do is they would use scotch tape and cigarette pack wrappings, and they would put scotch tape on these and fold it over and make these long strips. It's all this bright colors in different patterns. And then they would fold them into boxes or purses, you know, that had, you know, lids that were made out of scotch tape and paper. But when they were done, they were really pretty cool things, you know. It was pretty amazing. So there were a whole lot of guys that were doing that, and they'd ship them out of there. They'd ship them home, and then people would sell them and make money for them, you know. So when you're there, when you're actually in the prison, if you're good, you get days off for good times, which means days off the end of your sentence. And so I ended up spending, something like 4 months and 13 days instead of 6 months. It was something like that. Most of the Muslims got 2 or 3 years, and they were serving, you know, the whole time, or, you know, 18 months or 2 years, 2.5 years. They, you know, here I'm coming in after them and getting out in 4 months, you know. And there was a guy there from Texas who actually got 5 years. You know, he refused induction in Texas. They gave him 5 years. You know, and so there, I mean, there was this range of sentences for people who did the exact same thing based on things that had nothing to do with what they did. You know, it had to do with their, you know, black Muslims, you know, Nation of Islam. You know, these guys were un-American, you know, whereas I was just some white kid who made a mistake. You know, I mean, who knows how people looked at it, but, you know, it was that kind of thing. It was inequality in terms of the draft, because until the lottery, it was just poor people who couldn't go to college who got drafted.
My brothers.
Yeah, and so Cindy's brothers, both her brothers, you know, got screwed. And any millions of other people got screwed. And then, you know, here's the other inequality, is if you did refuse induction, then depending upon who you were, you got sentenced differently, or where you were, or like my attorney said, you know, was it a Nixon appointee or was it a Kennedy appointee? You know, there wasn't any equality or equity to the sentencing at all. And, you know, I was certainly glad enough to get out of there in 4 months and 13 days. But Peter, who is now a good friend, Peter Markovich, I think he got 2 years, and he ended up doing most of the 2 years. And he was sentenced before me, but had gone to Safford, found out that his appeal had been taken all the way to the Supreme Court, and so he got out and then had to come back. They would have these medical trials, and they would come to federal prisons and say, do you want to, instead of being in prison, you can be a part of this medical trial. And so he ended up being in a medical trial in his hometown of San Francisco. He told me the other day that when he first came to prison, I'd been there maybe a month, because it was actually on the election day when Nixon got elected. And so I was sitting out there and I was playing a song, and he was just feeling like utter shit. And he said, I walked into the yard and I heard your voice, and I said, I can do this. You know, and that was really cool to hear that, you know, that I kind of had that impact on him just at that moment. So then Cindy and I would trade letters regularly. Pretty much every day I wrote a letter, pretty much every day she wrote a letter. And so but the letters, I don't know how frequently they came out of the prison to you. For me, it was like they would come in clumps. It was clear to me that they were reading them. And Cindy's life while I was in prison was intriguing. I mean, she worked nights because she was trying to save up money to come visit me. And we found out that I could actually get conjugal visits. So she could actually come and get me and take me out of the prison for 12 hours. And that was like, all right, I'm glad we got married, she'd come and pick me up on a Saturday and we'd hop in the car and drive to a motel in Safford and just have a gay old time for the day, She'd bring all this food and we'd have sex however many times we wanted to have sex and eat food all day and just, really enjoyed the heck out of that one day. And so then, after 12 hours, she'd haul me back to prison and they'd, do a strip search of me and double check that I wasn't bringing some drugs back in with me. So she'd come back the next day and we'd hang out in the yard or whatever it was
Yeah.
and spend another 12 hours together eating food and talking and holding on to each other. And then she'd go away and, 4 months, 13 days, and I had three conjugal visits. That was pretty fortunate. And one of the things I really remember about that was I also would get a phone call, maybe it was every couple of weeks, something like that. Cindy would go over to my parents' house and I'd call over there and talk to all, both my parents and Cindy. And I remember really clearly one time my dad over the phone saying, I'm really proud of you. And that really meant a lot to me, and I knew I knew he felt that it was a good thing I did, but it was really nice to just hear that over the phone while you're there. So about a week before I got out of there was a riot, a full-blown riot, and people are throwing things and beating the crap out of each other, and this guy in front of me picks up this chair and swings it at me, and I stopped to avoid being hit by this chair. And this boulder hits me in the back of the head and knocks me to the ground. And I mean, I've still got a dent in the back of my head. And I remember thinking, I have to get out of here. And so I just took off running as fast as I could, just streaking for this door. And on my way, I got hit again in the side of the head, in the ear, and in the back of the arm, and finally made it into this door. I mean, I was in shock and just had the shit knocked out of me, So I had this Band-Aid and stitches on my head, and my ear was all fucked up, and I didn't even bother to tell Cindy. It was just before I got out. And so I said, okay, I get out on February 14th or whatever it was, February 13th. I said, midnight, I want to go to the airport. And they said, no problem. I mean, I'm sure they were ready to just don't sue us. So then Cindy got me a ticket, and midnight they drove me off to Tucson or Phoenix, and away I went and flew home.